Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome, and thank you very much for joining us for the first in our series, Reflections of the Morning Light, Mourning and Consolation in Jewish Law and Thought. I'd like to begin by thanking our sponsors, Alan and Rachel Friedman, who have sponsored this series in memory of Alan's mother, Devorah Friedman, and Alan and Evie Leifer, Alden Evie Leifer, in memory of Alden's parents, Chaim and Trudy Leifer, Chaim Ben Nachman Moshe, and Gifel Bas Shlomo Yaakov Halevi, Sechrono and Mavracha. We thank them very much for their support. This has been a topic, a series that I've had in mind to discuss and to prepare for some time. Unfortunately, over the past several months in particular, there have been too many, as far as I'm concerned, funerals in and around the community, and really just sort of nudged me forward to take advantage of this time, a period of time on the calendar, which is a time of mourning, not necessarily personal mourning, and we don't think necessarily of the Avelus, of the period of Sfira, as being associated with this type of mourning, but I think it's certainly an appropriate time for us to tap into the general theme of the calendar and talk about these important topics. Today's topic, a sacred passage escorting loved ones during the moments of death. I tried to be as clear and concrete as possible in preparing this title, because I want to make it very clear from the outset what in fact we will be discussing this evening and what we will not. So I want to begin by saying that this lecture will not address the following important topics. And I mean that they are important, that each and every one of the topics that are about to be listed need to be addressed. Some have been by myself. Others we can touch upon in the future. But I just want to say from the outset, because should anybody hear something tonight which sounds like it is instructive in some way or relates to any one of these topics, please understand that, you know, it should be taken as being a tangential comment and no more. Laws of caring for the terminally ill. That's a very important topic, one that we have given several shiurim on in the shul. Please, God, will continue to do so over the course of time. That's not what we're talking about tonight. That's a very important issue. It's a very important halachic issue, an emotional issue, a social issue. A halachic definition of death, what is considered to be death from the halacha's perspective, brain death, cardiac death, clinical definitions of death and how those are understood by poskim, also not a discussion for tonight. Hospice care and halacha, also a very, very important topic. Hospice and hospice care has become certainly more sought after over the past several decades, and many, many people have heard of hospice, many have experience with hospice. Certainly serves an important role in the greater community and at times in the Jewish from community as well. However, you should understand that that's not what we're going to be discussing tonight. Preparation of a halachic will, namely a will that can be used for the purpose of one's estate and dividing one's estate among children and other heirs. Preparation of a living will and or a health care proxy, also something we've discussed in the past, addressed in the drusha several months ago. And finally, preparation of an ethical will. These are all very important topics, but I want to stress that these are not really on tonight's agenda. And I'm telling you this from the outset, not so if you're disappointed you can leave, which you're welcome to, but more so because I just want to stress that if you hear things, and it seems like I'm commenting on these, you know, please understand that there's probably a lot more to say on each and every one of these topics. So what I would like to talk about tonight is a topic that is perhaps a source of stress for some and sadness for others. When you look at that word, maves, and the English translation of death, it's something that often conjures up feelings inside of fear, of fright, of sadness. Perhaps there are certain images and thoughts that come to mind when we hear about death. We think of pain and suffering and fear and unknown and just the end for each and every one of us. And that's something which is difficult. It's difficult to bear. It's difficult sometimes to process emotionally, which is one of the reasons why we don't really talk about death much, certainly more than we need to. However, what I'd like to present this evening, certainly the first few minutes of our lecture tonight, is that we consider viewing death from a different perspective. that we consider the possibility that that very same word, mavis and death, could be understood in somewhat of a different light. Namely, that we can speak about death as being an experience of transcendence, an experience of a spiritual transition, of closure for people on this earth as they prepare for a journey, as in fact we entitled today's shiur, Sacred Journeys into the Next World. And I think if we take a look at the words that the Torah uses, the Torah, we find psukim in Nach, and even the way our rabbis, Chazal, have referred to death, we can appreciate more the fact that death is not necessarily, as we said before, pain and suffering and gloom and doom and sadness and tragedy and destruction. One of the earliest references in the Torah to death, in this case, HaKadosh Baruch Hu addressing Avram Avinu and telling him, V'yata tavo el avasecha b'shalom, t'ikaver b'seva tova, that he says, Avram, you will, tavo, you will go. Now, we speak, the word tavo is a word that's used in everyday, very, you know, mundane discussions. We don't really think about death as coming or going. But that's exactly the word that the Torah uses at times to describe death. Vayigva vayomas Avraham. When Avram actually dies, several chapters later, the Torah describes death as vayigva, which is often translated as he expires. And the Mefarshim discuss what is the difference between vayigva and vayomas, as you find both of them over here. Vayayosef elamov, another expression that we find by the Avos, that he was gathered in. Sukkot, the happiest time of the year, is known as Chag Osif. So these are very different types of words that the Torah is using to describe death. A beautiful description of death, Yaakov, literally, on his deathbed, says, V'shachavti im avosai, that I will lie down with my fathers. We think about, you know, a person says, I'm going to lie down. Of course, we don't think about it in the morbid, mortal sense, nor should we. But when Yaakov was speaking about his impending death, that's the word that he uses, v'shachavti. Another beautiful word that is used, very unique word that is used by Yehoshua in his closing remarks to the people at the end of Sefer Yehoshua, v'hinei anochi holeich hayom b'derach kol ha'aretz. I am going today in the way of the world. I'm going to pass on. Tavo vayigva vayayasef v'shachavti holeich. And there are other words that are found in Tanakh. Three more words that Chazal used that are not necessarily based on psukim to my knowledge, but ptira, we say that a person is niftar, which means they have departed. A person has exited, or yitziah, which literally means to exit. And finally, menucha, which means to rest. Now this is very different than, I'm not going to roll all the slides back again, but you remember that first slide of death and maves and, you know, red, which again, it's difficult for us to bear and to think about and to wrap our head and our hearts around. The Torah is much more delicate and much more refined and perhaps in some ways trying to send us a message as to what in fact death really is. We all have, many of us have, discomfort and fear of death, and it's important to just spend a moment or two as we begin this discussion to talk about why that is. I haven't read any studies on this, and what I'm about to suggest may or may not really be of any value, but some thoughts to perhaps consider. Maybe the fact that we're forced to confront our own mortality is one of the reasons why we don't like talking about death. It's not necessarily because the death of others causes so much pain and anguish, which certainly at times it does. But death is something which makes us uncomfortable because we realize that that no one is immortal, and it will only be a matter of time before I too will die. We are therefore forced to confront our own unpreparedness. Am I ready? You know, when will I be ready? How much more do I need to do? How much more do I want to do before I leave this world? Of course, there's the fear of the unknown. We're going to share some perspectives tonight on what death is. According to Jewish tradition, at the end of the day, no one's ever gone and come back. I mean, there are reports of what people call near-death experiences, and the Talmud tells us certain stories of certain individuals who sort of got a peek in the world to come and came back after being resurrected. But really, it's unknown. And many of us fear the unknown. When we think about death, and particularly those around us who may find themselves in a situation where they're dying, we feel helpless. And often, that's a very uncomfortable feeling for us. When we feel that we can't do anything for the people around us who need us, that feeling of helplessness is one that makes us very uncomfortable. And finally, this is an interesting just sociological phenomenon, that there has been a shift over the course of time from people dying at home to dying in hospitals. There was a time where most people were born at home and people died at home. And birth and death was a much more comfortable, familiar experience, one that even children that today we would consider too young to attend a funeral, which is something that we'll talk about, please God, next week, they experienced it. They experienced not only in the most awful situations, such as the death camps, the concentration camps, but at home, even in peaceful situations, as their parents and grandparents, and if they result of their great-grandparents, would die in their home. Over the course of time, however, more and more people started dying in hospitals. And the result of that is that we become uncomfortable because we don't see it as much. We're not exposed to it as much. And suddenly we associate death with machines and life support and things which are, again, very foreign and very different than Vayigva, Vayasef, Shachavti, Holech, Menucha, Yitzia, Patira, those words that we saw earlier. A postscript to this last bullet over there, and that is that recent studies have shown that actually people are starting to die at home again. I hope that didn't sound wrong, but in other words, people are choosing to die at home, not only because home hospice care has become, you know, more available and something which is sought after more, but I think people have come to realize and appreciate that the experience of dying is one which can be just that, an experience, and not necessarily something that a person would want to do in a foreign environment, maybe not be, but maybe, you know, sterile from a, you know, from a perspective of medicine, but very foreign and maybe certainly hostile in other ways. And therefore, recently, I believe studies have shown that there have been more and more people who have been choosing to die at home. The Gemara in Brachos tells us, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rishum v'Rishum v'Yechai, Dor b'moy imo v'amar shira, when a person is developing in utero, an embryo, fetus rather, should sing a song, shira, as it says, Baruch Nafshi at Hashem, V'chol K'ravai Hashem Kadsho, and the Gemara understands that this is talking about what? A baby who's developing before being born. Yatzalav Yira Olam, a child comes into this world and looks at the beautiful world and the sun and the stars and the moon and says Shira. And the Gemara goes on to highlight important stages in a person's life. And most remarkably, the Gemara says at the end, Nistaka B'yom Amisa V'yom HaShira. A person comes to look, to stare, to gaze at the Yom HaMisa, and burst forth in shira and song. That's a very strange idea. After all, who would think about singing on a day of Misa? The Gemara in Magen Katan tells us, when you're at a funeral, b'chula avelim v'lo la'avela. You're going to cry? You should cry, but you should cry for the avelim, for the mourners, for their sense of loss, for the fact that there's someone who is important to them, who is no longer part of their lives in a physical sense, v'lo la'aveda. But don't mourn, don't cry for the loss of the person, shehi lemenucha, v'anu la'anocha, because he, the neshama, is now lemenucha. That's that word that I used earlier. Now at rest, now at peace. V'anu la'anocha, we are left feeling bereft. We are left in agony. The Gemara Navos teaches, the Mishnah Navos, Hu ha'yomer hayilodim lamus v'hamesin leheichayos, which is probably best translated literally as, he would say, Hayulodim Lamus, when a person is born, they are destined to die. Vahamesim, and those who die, Lehechayos, are destined to live. A very different perspective on life and death. We usually think of life as being the beginning and death being an end. But what do we say each and every day in our davening? Just stop for a moment and think about the words that we say. Melech Memis Mechaya. We don't say that Hashem is Mechaya u'Memis. That God is the one who's Memis, that he brings death into the world, and the next stage is umechaya, a completely different perspective. A pasuk of Kohelet, which is Tov Shem Mishem and Tov, and we're going to focus more on the latter half of the pasuk. V'yom ha'maves miyom hivaldo. Tov yom ha'maves miyom hivaldo. The day of death is tov. Again, forgive me if this is not the best translation, but it's better than, is more good than yom hivaldo, than the day of one's birth. And why should that be? So the Yalkim Shimoni tells us, no let adam akol smechem. The way the world is, that when a person is born, everyone's happy. Meis akol bochem, that everybody cries when he dies. The eno came, but it shouldn't be that way, say Chazal. No let adam akol smechem livkos. When a person is born, everyone should cry. Because no one has no way of knowing where this child will be in 10 and 20 and 30 and 40, 50 years. What will become of this life? When a person dies, we should be happy, relieved almost, because this person has now made it to the next stage of their journey. I don't believe that Chazal are actually instructing us to cry, to tear kriya, to mourn at the birth of a child, and to actually break into a horror dance at a funeral. But, to a certain point, Chazal are telling us, what is it that Shlomo Melech, the wisest of all men, is telling us when he says, Tov yom ha'maves miyom hivaldo. He says there is something about birth which is very special, but then again there's so much unknown. There are so many things that could go wrong. There's a potential for fulfilled potential, and there's potential for things to just not go the way they could have been and should have been. However, when it comes to yom ha'maves, so then that is the ship returning home, as the Medrash goes on to give a mashal that you may have read. There is a book, a very, very famous book, it's actually three volumes, on Avelos. It's called Gesher Achayim. It's probably, it's only been around for less than 100 years, so you can't call it an all-time classic. But there are many, many svarim on Avelos, which have been published in the last 100 years, and all of them, without exception, quote from the Gesher Achayim. So the Gesher Achayim is sort of like a Bible of sorts, to those who are learning and studying and being ma'ayin into not just the laws of Avelos in a very technical sense, and it is a wonderful resource of that, in that extent, but also to talk about issues of life and death, and this world and the next world. And the Gesher Achayim, in the third volume, focuses more on the philosophy of life and death. It was written by Rabbi Chiel Michal Tukachinsky. You can see over here he died, in 1955, so, you know, this is not the sefer that was written such a long time ago. The book is called Gesher Chaim, and it presents with the perspective on life, viewing life as a bridge. Now, that's not all that different than the Chazal told us, that this world is the prozor, which means it's the entranceway to the trachlin, to the palace that comes. A very different perspective on life. And he uses this incredible analogy, which takes him really several pages to develop, in which he discusses birth from the womb as being the birth of the body, and death as being the birth of the soul. A very, very different perspective on life. And he says that it takes 9 months or so for a baby to develop, for a life of 70, 80, 90 years in this world, a world which is limited in some ways, a world which has lots of opportunity, but is not unlimited. And when a person makes it through this world, so this world is like the stage of pregnancy, if you will, for the next world. And this concept is one which was the inspiration for a song that I'd like to play to you. For those who are a little firmer than I and don't want to hear music right now, because it's Svira, I won't be insulted if you step out, but I'm passing it for all of you, you can listen to the song. It's a beautiful song. If you've heard it before, I encourage you to listen to it again like you've never heard it before. The song is on the first Journeys album, but it is based on this mashal of the Gesher Achayim. Maybe Rottenberg did not create the concept behind it, but he put beautiful melody and words to it.
My dear brother, look around and tell me what your eyes behold. Don't deny that you see. It's only you and me. Our existence is empty. It is cold. Our existence is empty. It is cold. But dear brother, you must have faith that we are not the only ones. Cause in the distance there's a place where we stand on common strength. Oh, brother. Don't be blind, don't be stubborn, don't be set. Imagination's alright, but it won't light up the night. What you see is exactly what you get. What you see is exactly what you get. But dear brother, you will surely find when all is said and done that the future it will show there is so much we don't know. Oh, I believe that there is a world to come.
That's a nice song. That's a nice, not just because it's a nice song. I think I heard that song for the first time probably 20, 25 years ago. It's, you know, it's as beautiful now as one was the first time I heard it. And it's a tremendous chizuk, because, again, capturing very beautifully, artistically, this teaching of the Gesher HaChaim, which is really a very elaborate way of presenting that which Chazal tell us, it reminds us that our perspective in life is very limited. And we think that we know everything. We think that we've seen everything. But really, it's all relative. And in this hypothetical conversation in a womb, two children, or babies, or not even babies, are having a conversation which is not all that different than the conversations that people have sometimes at work, and maybe even at school, as to whether or not you believe in the world to come. And, you know, many of the themes that we have already touched upon are highlighted in that song. Another beautiful quote from the Gesher HaChaim, he writes, "The birth, life, and death testify to one another. The three are tied together in a single knot. Were there no past or future, there would be no present. There are three births, conception, emergence from the womb, and departure from the body. One stage forms a transition to the next. The first leads to the second is the preparation for a purposeful life, while the third constitutes the achievement of that objective." There's another book, which is not a holy book, if you will. It's not a book that you'd find in most farm stores, but it's a book called On Death and Dying, on many of the topics that we've already started to talk about. And this is written by a psychiatrist, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who died a little more than 10 years ago, was a noted psychiatrist and a pioneer in near-death studies. Near-death studies are different than And near-death awareness, which Tom will talk about a little bit, is different than near-death experiences. Near-death experiences, which is, I guess, studied as a science, Some would argue it's a little more science fiction or perhaps a little more off. Near-death experiences are what people report when they've been declared clinically dead for a certain period of time and then come back. And it's been noted and studied that people, all different languages and cultures and time periods, have reported very similar experiences, which makes one wonder, you know, whether or not these people have actually experienced something on the other side. Near-death studies is very different. Here is a woman, a psychiatrist, who began to explore what was going through the minds of people who were dying, and how could she help them communicate with people around her, and how could she be able to help people, nurses, doctors, other caretakers, therapists, and family members, help assist their family members who were dying. And she has several books on this topic. This, I think, is considered to be the most famous of all. I've actually read this book, although it was many years ago. I went through it again recently quickly just to find a couple of important ideas. She's the one who presents this very famous idea of five stages of grief, which many people have heard of. Just going to go through it very briefly because it's helpful for the purpose of the discussion. She outlines what is typically, not always, of course there are exceptions, but typically the pattern that we find in people who have been told that they are going to die. And this can play out in a similar way to family members of people who are terminally ill, but the real study is about the individuals themselves. First comes a period of denial, where individual believes that the diagnosis is a mistake, and they cling to a false, preferable reality. Seeking a second opinion is not denial. Seeking 20 second opinions is, and that's something that we sometimes find. Anger is when a person recognizes that they can no longer be in denial, and they become very frustrated, especially with people around them, and sometimes start to lash out at God, at the people around them, and just become very angry. Then comes a bargaining stage in which a person tries to make deals, usually with God. If you give me another chance, I'll do this and that. And remarkably, sometimes that seems to work, whether that's what's working or something else is happening. We don't know, but there are times when people make it to the bargaining stage and then seem to get what we call a new lease on life. After the bargaining stage, people fall into a period of depression in which they don't want to speak to anyone or be with anyone, and they usually turn visitors away at that time. And finally, a period of acceptance, which we hope will be what a person will be feeling and experiencing when leaving this world, and that is that if I can't fight it, I might as well prepare for it and embrace it and try to make amends with people in this world and really, you know, prepare for this transition, for this journey, as it's just that. These were her famous five stages of grief. And it's important to be aware of this and understand that, you know, these types of experiences are very common among, you know, all populations, and it's part of our hardwiring. And if and when we find ourselves in these situations, know what to anticipate and don't necessarily think that something is wrong or off schedule, if you will, if someone is very in denial or someone is very angry or bargaining, etc. Just somewhat of a different presentation of this model. Also highlighting the moods that the person may feel and the sort of assistance that the person may not need during different stages. There's another book that I read more recently, which is called Final Gifts. This is about understanding the special awareness needs and communications of the dying. This is a really fascinating book. It's one that I actually wish I had read many years earlier. I didn't, but I recommend it to everyone because in all likelihood, there will be times in your life in which things that you're reading here will be very helpful for you. They talk about what's called a near-death awareness, and that is a special knowledge about and sometimes a control over the process of dying. And nearing death awareness reveals what dying is like and what is needed in order to die peacefully. It develops in those who are dying slowly. The attempts of dying people to describe what they're experiencing may be missed, misunderstood, or ignored because the communication is obscure, unexpected, or expressed in symbolic language. So there are many examples that are given in this book about people who are dying and sometimes pointing to as if they see someone and no one's there, and people saying things like, get me a map, I need a map, or, you know, where's my suitcase, or speaking in other languages that they maybe spoke as a child, or saying that they see or they've spoken to family members of theirs that had passed away many years ago. And people sometimes dismiss this as being hallucination or a person is very confused. Maybe it's the effects of the morphine. And we can't dismiss any of those. However, it's been, I think, proven that we find again and again and again that people who are lucid and people who are not under the influence of sedatives of that nature, and people, like I said before, of all different backgrounds and cultures and lifestyles and languages and time periods, experience very, very similar things. And in fact, what may be happening over here is that they are trying to communicate with us. We just have to know what it is that they're trying to be, what they're trying to say. And I think what she says over here is what I just said. There's a universal familiarity, and for centuries, many of this has been documented. This is what they cover in this book. So some of the examples in this book. This is very important. And many of these, by the way, reflect really what Chazal have told us about the process of dying and what we should expect. Contrary to popular belief, or perhaps from wishful thinking, because of our own discomfort with death, dying people know that they are dying, even if no one else knows or has told them. Of course, that's not always so. There are times that people die tragically, and we sometimes say, well, they said this yesterday, this did last week, who knows? But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a person who is ill, is terminally ill, has been given a diagnosis, but they don't know if it could be days, weeks, months, who knows what, but they have a sense. They attempt to share this information by using symbolic language to indicate preparation for a journey or change soon to happen. Travel is a clear metaphor often used to describe this need to go forth and to die. Dying people often seem to know when their death will occur, sometimes right down to the day or hour. It would not be appropriate for me to be too specific over here. It's very likely that you have your own experiences or stories, but I have a surprising number of experiences in this regard where people have done just that. They have made it very, very clear when they are going to die. They've either said it straight out or made, you know, comments like, I'm going back to my parents on Shabbos, you know, a week beforehand, which is an example that comes to mind because it just happened a couple of months ago. But these type of experiences are not unusual. Again, sometimes they may be very vague and subtle, and sometimes we just say these people are confused. But this, in fact, is a reality. Some dying people realize that they will die more peacefully under certain conditions. Until those conditions are met, they may delay the timing of the death. This differs from knowing when they will die. Some people do know and do indicate when death will happen. Others actually choose the moment of death. You may be aware of a situation that goes something like this. Someone is very ill in the hospital or at home, and among the family members or friends, they keep a vigil and do not leave this individual alone around the clock because they don't want this person to be alone when they die. And then it happens to be that if someone shifts and they're sitting there 5, 10, 20 hours at a time and they step out for a moment to go to the bathroom, and at that moment precisely the person dies. And for days and weeks afterwards the person feels guilty that they weren't there. But the way this is explained, according to the research that's been done in this very impressive work, is that, and this is not uncommon, this type of situation, as that there are times that people choose to die alone. They want it to be that way for whatever reason, and it doesn't make a difference, you know, how long you would have stayed in the room. They would have waited for that moment, that window, in order to let go. And on the other hand, we've heard stories of people who seem to hold on and on and on and on until the last third cousin makes their way from California and says goodbye, and then sometimes within minutes, they just expire. And there are many, many stories like this. What are we supposed to do? What are our obligations? What is our role? Being the family members, the caretakers, the friends of people who are dying. So, the Gemara in Shabbos tells us, in the name of the Rabbanan, the Brisa, Tan Rabbanan, Mishachalav Natalamus, Omrim Lo Hisvadeh, Shekein Kol Hamumsim Misvadeh. A person who is very close to death should be told to confess, to be told to repent. The Rambam in the beginning of Hilchos Tshuva tells us that whenever a person is seeking to do tshuva, vidui, confession, is a necessary component to the tshuva process. It doesn't make a difference whether it's Aser Simei Tshuva, which is when people often study Hilchos Tshuva, or as the Rambam says, when a person brings a korban, or if a person is punished by Bezdin, a person is given lashes, or a person is executed by Bezdin. No matter what the circumstances are, whenever a person is engaged in tshuva, there must be a confession. That is part of the tshuva process. And we would expect and hope and want to encourage, we'll talk a little more about how this can be done delicately, but we would want to encourage people who are still lucid and aware of what's happening to engage in tshuva. Chazal have a perspective that we should look at every day of our life in this world as if it may be the last, and therefore we should always prepare as if, and do tshuva every day. That would be wonderful, but that's a very idealistic view, which very few people are able to achieve. The reality is that when we're in good health, perfectly good health, the relative good health, we don't look at every single day as if it's probably or likely or even possibly going to be our last. However, when a person knows that they're not coming out of the hospital alive, when a person is already in hospice, so it's appropriate for this person, either on their own or with the encouragement of others, if necessary, to begin the process of tshuva. Now in Shulchan Aruch in Yeridei Hashimon Lamed Ches, which is the end of the laws of Bikur Cholim, which then transitions to the laws of Avelus, the Machaber tells us that, just as we saw, when a person is headed towards death, they should be told to repent. And you should say to this person, Omrim lo, harbe hizvadu velo mesu, v'harbe lo hizvadu mesu. Don't worry, many people have confessed and they have not died, and many people have not confessed and they have died. In other words, this is not a surrender. This is not giving in, it's not throwing in the towel. U'b'schar shatam hizvadu t'chai, who knows, maybe in the reward for your confession, you'll live. We try to encourage a person. This is not a script. I wouldn't recommend that you stand in front of a person and read it like that. But the idea is you try to remind a person, listen, don't panic. This is not, you know, you forgive me, bringing in the priest. This is an important thing to do. And in no way whatsoever does this mean that you're throwing in the towel or that we're giving up on you or anything like that. The Aruch HaShulchan highlights the fact that in general we are very careful not to do anything which would aggravate or distress a person who's ill, certainly a person who's what's called a ghost face, and we'll define that in a moment, a person who's very ill, on the verge of death, and therefore, he says you have to be very careful and very delicate when talking about this issue. At the same time, it's an important issue that should be discussed, that should be shared with the person who's dying, and as much as we may find it difficult and uncomfortable, we should not shy away from that. The Shulchan Aruch actually tells us that individuals who may not be able to hold themselves together should leave the room when a vidui is being recited. It is not appropriate to have family members standing around and crying. So if that is the way a person feels, we're not talking about the patient, but if other family members can't handle it, then they should excuse themselves, because really, ideally, it should be carried out in a state of composure and not be perceived as something which would cause panic. This is straight out of the Madrich, the Rabbi's Handbook. There are many different versions of the vidui. Some are many, many pages. Some are one line. And this is sort of the bare bones, the bare minimum, if you will. In Chas V'Shalom Amos, Tehimi Sasi Kapara Al Kol Avonosai. If God forbid I should die, my death should be a kapara, an atonement for all of my sins. At the very least, that's a vidui. There's a longer version which follows, and this is not the longer version. The really longer version, like I said, is many, many pages. And there are those that say that really a vidui before a person dies should be a vidui like we do on Yom Kippur, when a person goes through not necessarily literally the whole list of al-chetz, but why not? A person should try to recount and mention all of one's sins. The Shalach says there's a mitzvah of gemilas chesed, we know, bikur cholim, and we know how important that is to try to help a person who's physically ill. But it says if we're concerned about one's guf, about one's physical well-being, how much more so, Tavachoma, we should be concerned about a person's neshama. And this is the way we demonstrate it, by a guy trying to help a person in such a state come to the realization of their own mortality, which they may realize at this point, and talk to them about the importance of tshuva. And one of the ways we do this is by encouraging people to make amends with people that they have perhaps offended. We encourage them to try to remember any money that they may owe to people, any unpaid debts, either literally monetary debts or other types of debts. These are the types of things, says the Shalom, if we can discuss with a person in the situation, we're doing them a great tova. Again, it sort of goes against perhaps our nature, which is try to be as soothing and calming in such a state, but if we really believe, as we should, that this person is now preparing for a journey, and they'll be better off when they get there if they have their passport and they have their ticket and they have their suitcase. You know, you'll forgive the analogy. It's not meant to sound inappropriate, but just like we would send off any of our loved ones on a journey, you know, ready for the trip, this is the way we prepare people for this trip. But again, it's very important to realize and to recognize that common sense must prevail in these situations, and one should never cause distress to a person in these situations. In that book that I mentioned before, Final Gifts, they touch upon this as well, and the realization, the need for reconciliation is part of the need for that awareness. In other words, there are times that people who are in this state themselves initiate this process and begin to show signs of repentance and remorse and begin to ask to speak to people and try to contact people who have been estranged. These are normal experiences that we find with people in this situation. The other laws and customs regarding vidui, just somewhat quickly, just to go through them, if one can no longer speak, which is sometimes the case, we encourage this person, as long as they are aware and awake, to confess belave, which means in their heart, in their mind. Even after one has lost consciousness, one should say it to him or for him. I say two or four because it's not always clear which one it is, but there is such an idea that even if a person is no longer responsive, if vidui has not been said earlier, it could still be said at that point, even on Shabbos and Yom Tov. If you find yourself in that situation, we encourage this person to grant mechila to any individuals that he has held a grudge against, and others should be mochel him at such a time. Giving tzedakah, a special donation to a public of communal needs, in particular, this is something which is mentioned by the poskim. The Gemara tells us that if a person stole money and he doesn't know who he stole from, what you should do is you should give money to communal needs. This way, hopefully, the victim of your theft will somehow benefit from your returning it. So there's an idea that if a person is dying, they should try to clean their hands, nekicha b'ayim, avalevav, as much as they can, and you know that's one of the ways that a person does so, by giving tzedakah. I even saw that brought down. This is not like a halachic checklist. You have to, but always brought down brichos habanim, just like parents bless their children on Lel Shabbos before Yom Kippur, other times, the day of a wedding, that this is a time as well when it's appropriate for a person to give a blessing to his or her children. The Gemara in Maseches Smachot, which is one of the Masechtos Ketanos, I don't know how many people here have heard of this, but there's a collection of Masechtos that are not as well known. They're not part of the regular cycle of the Talmud Bavli, the way we study it. And people don't always know about them, but they're called the smaller mini Masechtos. One of them is called Masechtos Smachot, which is actually about Avelos, and it's about death, it's about these topics. At the very beginning it says, a Goses, Hareyu Kachai L'chol Dagar. A Goses is a person who is on the verge of death. It is very difficult to define a Goses, both in clinical terms, and perhaps even more so in halachic terms, and to find a definition that really works and that can be understood and applied on the scene. I'd like to say you'll know when you see it, but that's not necessarily so. It would not be responsible for me to say that. A person who is terminally ill is not necessarily a goseis. A person who is told by the doctors you only have a month to live or a week to live is also not necessarily a goseis. But a goseis is a person who the process of death in the most imminent sense has started. So you would perhaps see significant changes in their breathing patterns, major changes in blood pressure and other things. These are indications that a person is now a goseis and likely going to die soon. When a person is a goseis, Chazal say they are completely 100% alive, which means we do not give up on that person. We don't do anything, obviously, to hasten their death. And even being mechalel Shabbos, etc., the types of things that we would do for anyone else, we would not differentiate, distinguish between anyone, any chole, and a person who's a goseis. And then Chazal say, be very careful not to touch a goseis, because if you touch a goseis, you can actually, you can be responsible for hastening the death. Remeir gives a mashal for a flickering candle, a flickering flame. When a flame is starting to flicker, if you touch the candle sometimes, it will go out. So closing the eyes of a goseis, malin alav ki'ilu hushomet et nishmaso, is very, very strong words. It's a question among the poskim as to what this means. I don't feel comfortable at the moment giving you any definitive guidelines or answers, partially because it's not 100% clear to me, and I don't think in general there's a consensus about the post and what a goseis is. But one of the questions that sometimes up when a person wants to hold the hand of a loved one who is at this stage, and it may depend on several factors. But just to be aware that this is a question. The Aruch HaShulchan says that even though when we see a person in such a state, we may be inclined to say, oh, enough already, the person is suffering, and we may be inclined to tell, you know, push the button again, give morphine, and just end it, because it's clear that, you know, that the end is near. We shouldn't do that. Rather, we should let HaKadosh Baruch Hu run his world, and the Ratzon of Hashem should play out the way it wants to. And certainly, I hope this is obvious, we don't want to go ahead and start preparing the Aron and the Tachrichim and calling the Chaver Kadisha when the person is still alive. This is very important. Believe it or not, I've seen people, good people, sensible people, not thoughtless, cruel people, but sometimes standing within earshot of a person who's dying and starting to talk about, you know, where a funeral will be, when it will be, and we have to be very sensitive to that because we don't know whether or not a person hears or not, even if they're no longer able to physically hear. If death is understood as a transition, which it is, and some of these people near-death awareness, or near-death experiences certainly, it's reported sort of seeing their body from, you know, almost like having this floating experience. We want to be very sensitive to that and not, you know, speak as a person has died before they have.
Rabbi, are you saying that you are allowed to hold their hand?
Specifically said that I am not prepared at the moment to give any concrete guidelines because cases are so nuanced and so specific. So what I'm saying is that we should be aware of the fact that it's a question, and therefore if a person finds him or herself in this situation, they should seek halakhic counsel. That's really the best I can tell you right now. But what I am saying is that the period of gesisa, when a person is ghostface, is a relatively short period of time. You know, it doesn't go on for days. So we're not talking about a scenario where... Best English translation, again, I don't know if there's a word for it. Person is on the verge of death. If there's a word, someone knows.
Translated as person's moribund.
Okay. Thank you very much. Moribund. Okay, very good. The Aruch HaShulchan over here, I'm concerned for the clock, so I'm going to try to move through this quickly. I'm just going to talk to you outside about what the Aruch HaShulchan says. Talks about this a little more and says that it's important that any handling of a ghost case be done with care. So whether it's a question of adjusting a pillow and taking a pillow out or putting one in, we should be careful with this, and we should be thoughtful. The Aruch HaShulchan quotes the Rama, who differentiates between doing anything which hastens the death, which is prohibited. On the other hand, says the Rama, removing something which is an impediment or an obstruction to death is permissible. So it's a strange example. The Rama says if there's a guy outside in the street who's knocking a hammer, and it's clear that the sound of that knock is sort of, the person is consciously sort of following along. You can tell a person to stop. Stop. It's probably based on a story. The Gemara tells a story about one of the Tanoim who was on the verge of death, and there was this noise outside. They probably told them to stop, and then the person died. This can be applied to other situations which involve, you know, other forms of medical intervention and forms of life support, not in all situations, but we're not permitted to hasten one's death. We're not required to extend it in these circumstances either. When one finds himself, I meant to keep that at the end. That's my technical glitch, but don't read that yet. Final moments. These are really the final moments when a person dies. So just to review some of the I'll call them halachos. Understand that some of these are actual dinim, and some are traditions. And this is definitely an area in halacha where, you know, it's not clear what is actual halacha, what is more minhag. But you know, I'm going to try to present it, as comprehensively as I can. A ghost should not be left alone. Again, it's hard for me to imagine a situation where a person would deliberately do so anyway. So forgive me if this is obvious, but it should be stated that the halacha says we should not leave a person alone in such a situation. On the other hand, we don't want to lose too much emotion or say anything which would aggravate, frighten, or disturb or distress a ghost in this situation. I put in parentheses a minion. This is not a halacha, but there is a tradition that's brought down in certain Kabbalistic sources that a minion is to be gathered at the time that a person is dying. I'm aware of several situations where people had made this request. It was due to the fact that they were aware of this as being something that they wanted to do for their loved one, and time allowed for that, and circumstances allowed. When a minion is gathered, it doesn't mean you have to have a minion in the room necessarily, but you have a minion present. It's sort of a higher level, if you will, of experiencing this. I can certainly understand why certain people may feel that that's not appropriate for them. They may want a certain degree of privacy and don't want to have strangers coming to the house at that time, which is completely understandable, and that's why I'm putting in parentheses. This is not required, but if you overhear of such a thing, you know where it's coming from. to share and study Divrei Torah. It's not the time necessarily to review the Daf Yomi, but it is appropriate, especially if the person who is dying is still aware and conscious and is able to appreciate a Torah thought. Not let me tell you something nice on the parsha, but you know to say some of the Mamori Chazal that we've mentioned this evening, to speak about you know the Torah perspective on now what's about to happen, so that a person should have on their literally on their lips, on their minds, on their heart as they transition into the next world, words of Torah. Tehillim can be recited with, to, by, in the presence of the person who is dying. Some of the other familiar passages which are brought down is to recite Yigdal, Adon Olam, and Aleinu. It's remarkable because these are some of the first things that children learn when they're in school. These are just, you know, they sort of roll off our tongues, and we think of them sometimes as being, you know, almost like, you know, child songs. But, you know, some of the most inspirational moments on this earth, when a person is in the presence of a person who's dying and is able to say or to sing Adon Olam with such a person, and you realize at that moment how extraordinary the words of Adon Olam are. This is, again, a picture of what's coming out of the Madras, of the things that, again, timing doesn't always work. It just doesn't, but that could and should be said at the moment that a person is dying, of Mikel Chamocha, B'yadachat Kidruchi, V'rechacha, Shema Yisrael, Baruch Shem, etc. Yes.
If we say a ghost should not be left alone, doesn't that contradict what we said before about someone wants to die, you sometimes wait for people to leave?
Right. So we don't leave a ghost alone. Sometimes it happens that a person is alone. It's just either inevitable or maybe it's not. And when that happens, we find that sometimes such a person passes away. I am not aware of I haven't seen in either in halachic literature or in the other literature that I'm quoting from as well, unless a person has been told, please leave me alone, that we should step out of the room. But it may be that a person is waiting for that moment where a person dozes off for a moment and closes their eyes, only to wake up and see that their loved one has passed away. It could be that that was a deliberate choice for the person to wait for that moment to leave this world. And my point is that one should not feel guilty if that happens, but not that we would actually suggest that a person should be left alone. I say to people who care for people who are dying, if you really love that person and want to help them, be with them when their end comes close, sit with them, you don't even have to talk, you don't have to do anything, but really be there with them. That's again from Elizabeth Ross, who we quoted earlier from Death and Dying. After the time is passing, first of all, determine death. I'm not sure that that's something that anyone can necessarily do. Chazal speak about taking a feather and placing it by the nose of the individual and waiting some time and seeing whether or not there's any movement. Of course, there is some question about brain death and cardiac death, but breathing is a necessary bodily function. There's no way that a person can leave without breathing. However, I must warn you that unless you really know what you're doing, you should not necessarily rely on your own judgment when it comes to determining death. Here again, in my own experience, there have been times where long periods of time have passed, believe it or not, over an hour, maybe longer, with people standing around and simply not knowing whether or not a person is alive or dead. Clearly, the person was not coming back. But, you know, every situation is unique, and there has to be a proper determination of death before, you know, before what anything that follows next happens. It's contact the rabbi, the Chaver Kadisha. The Brach of Dayan Emes is recited. However, I put that with an asterisk as well as Kriya, because the minhag is usually to wait until later, until the funeral service, to do the Kriya. There are reasons for this as to why we wait until that period of time. We're not going to get to that now. Maybe I'll pick up on the next week. I'll talk to that point. If you said Baruch Dayan Emes at that point, or if you tore Kriya, that's okay. Really, the halacha says that everyone who's present at the moment of Yitzias Neshama should tear Kriya and recite Baruch Dayan Emes, not only the family members, but typically, family members are instructed to follow the prevalent custom, which is to wait until the time before, during, or after the funeral, depending on the local custom as to when Kriya should be done. Close the eyes and the mouth of the Nifter. The eyes usually close very easily, the mouth not necessarily. If it closes easily, fine. And if it doesn't, it's recommended that take a cloth or something to tie it. This may be comfortable and easier for some to do than others. And here again, we have a concept of Kavod HaMeis, we also have a concept of Kavod HaChayim. People have to know what they can do and know their limitations, and maybe this is something that's best left for the Chevra Kadisha, but just to be aware that this is something that's brought down and something that is done for a person to pass away. Body should be placed directly on the floor. This is, very rarely is this done in hospitals. Most hospitals would not want this, would not allow this. It is not appropriate to start, you know, taking it up with the nurses and telling them that this is your tradition. Perhaps the hospitals in Eretz Yisrael and maybe in Brooklyn are a little more accommodating, I don't know. But this is not something that we've seen done here, typically. But if a person dies at home, again, there may be other situations, reasons why this may not be a good idea. If a person is hooked up to certain tubes, if they have certain pressure sores and other things, that it would not be a good idea to start handling the mace, then it is absolutely better to leave a person. But just to be aware that there is a concept that when a person dies, they are placed directly on the floor and covered with a white sheet. Candles should be lit, at least one placed near the head of the nifter. Again, this is not done in hospitals, for obvious reasons. We don't light candles in the hospital. But at home, this is something to be done. I say candles because there are different customs. I've seen 3, 7, 26. I've heard all different types of customs. This idea of pouring out the water, poured water, not pouring out everything in the house that is either made of water. But this is already, you know, I'm really running out of time. That's a topic in of itself. This is a custom. It's a custom, and there are reasons as to why it is that we pour out water in the house. The body should not be left alone. The concept of Shmira. Shmira is primarily al-pidin, so that the body not be exposed to anything which could hurt the body. If there are, let's say, rodents in the area, or there's concern for fire or extreme elements, these situations are very rare today when people die in the hospital or at home. Al-pidin, once the person is protected from the elements, certainly once a person is put in a box or in a refrigerator, at that point, al-pidin shmir is not required. There are still some who try to offer what they perceive to be, in fact, maybe this is so, a greater cover to the mace, and that is that someone is always standing by and vigil, you know, until the funeral takes place, so sitting outside the morgue, the refrigerator, whatever it is, saying Tehillim, this is appropriate, not a discussion for now, but this is not necessarily appropriate to the point where people should feel compelled to spend money on it, when certain Chavei Kadishas offer that, or that there should be, I don't want to use the word imposition, but it has to be thought out from the perspective of community, what's appropriate in terms of offering shmira around the clock, etc., this and that. But al-pidin, the concept of shmira is to make sure that the body is not at any risk of becoming, hurt, defiled in any way. It is appropriate even after, precisely after the person has passed away, to after mechila from the nifter, if there's been any disrespect in any way that's shown to the individual, to recite the Tehillim, which is often what shomrim do. People who are serving as a shomer are not supposed to learn Torah because of the concept of loig l'rush, which means we are sensitive not to literally mock the person who has passed away, who is no longer able to do mitzvot. We don't want to sit there and learn and do mitzvot, even a concept when a person is in the cemetery, to make sure that their tzitzis are tucked in. This is an idea from the Gemara, not to walk around with your tzitzis dragging over the stones, because that shows insensitivity towards the nifter who can't do mitzvot anymore. We'll never know, at least on this side, how much any particular person who's deceased is upset by seeing our tzitzis, but more than anything else, this law, these halachos, sensitize us just to the point of just being sensitive in general, sensitive to all people. When we have something that they don't, that we should be mindful of that and not flaunt it. And again, perhaps this should be obvious, but it needs to be said because, you know, I haven't been around that long, but I've been around long enough to know that this is not always obvious. There should be COVID rosh. COVID rosh means there should be a serious mood around the mace. People who are involved in professionally in the handling of mace, people work in funeral homes, funeral directors, so it's a tremendous challenge for them. And one of the things that has always made me uncomfortable in funeral homes is the fact that the whole thing is just so professional-like and business-like, and the handling of the mace, even when it's done technically with respect, just doesn't seem to be done with a sense of awe and reverence, which is understandable. In fact, I always say to the funeral directors, we should meet at happy occasions. It almost never happens. One time, I met a local funeral director at a wedding, and I gave him the biggest hug in the world, and then it finally happened. We met at a happy occasion. But normally, funeral directors, you don't meet them at happy occasions. And, you know, that's a tremendous challenge for them. But for most of us who are not involved in this professionally, and hopefully not on a regular basis, it should come naturally that there should be a sense of COVID rosh. But if you've been sitting with somebody for 2-3 weeks who's been dying, and finally that moment comes, there is a moment of relief that sets in. And of course, it's not going to be expressed as joy, but you know, we still have to, you know, capture that moment for what it is and understand that something truly extraordinary has just taken place. And while, you know, we are relieved, not for ourselves only, but relief for the person who is perhaps suffering, it's still a very sacred moment. It's an extraordinary moment, and it's one that should be preserved in that sense, and there should be a sense of COVID rosh. I'll conclude. I wanted to conclude with a quote from the Geshe Rosh Chaim, but I found this first, so forgive me for concluding a shir, but I thought this was beautiful. Those who have the strength and the love to sit with a dying patient in the silence that goes beyond words will know that this moment is neither frightening nor painful, but a peaceful cessation of the functioning of the body. Watching a peaceful death of a human being reminds us of a falling star, one of a million lights in a vast sky that flares up for a brief moment only to disappear into the endless night forever. To be a therapist to a dying person makes us aware of the uniqueness of each individual in this vast sea of humanity. It makes us aware of our own finiteness, our limited lifespan. Few of us live beyond a 70 years, and yet in that brief time, most of us create and live a unique biography and weave ourselves into the fabric of human history. Really a beautiful quote, and one that sort of captures so much of what we tried to share this evening. Thank you again for joining us this evening, and please return next week when we are going to talk about and to the dust you shall return before, during, and after the Levaya.